Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's part two of today's Q&A with Layla, and we've got additional questions to answer. So what's up next, Layla?
Okay, our next question is from Harry. In a recent podcast, Dr. Palviak discussed the benefits of xylitol. Dr. Hoffman asked about how to get a one-year-old to use xylitol. However, the question was never answered.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I felt bad because I put the question to him, and then he went off in a different direction. We ran out of time.
Yeah.
So that's a good question. And so Dr. Palviak was talking about xylitol for prevention of dental caries. And he actually has a lot of experience as a dentist and as an epidemiologist studying this problem. And in fact, they've managed to virtually eradicate tooth decay in Finland with a national policy whereby they give kids xylitol gum. And by the way, xylitol is very, very common as a sweetener in Finland because it's made from birch bark, and they got a lot of birch trees there. It's not really economical to make it from birch bark throughout the world, but in Finland they got a lot of birch trees. So it's a birch, it's also referred to as birch sugar, and it's a non-caloric sugar that prevents dental decay. It's also, we use it in clear, X-L-E-A-R, which is helpful for preventing nasal bacteria, nasal infections, and fungal infections. So anyway, so for a small child, you can't get a small child of one to chew gum. That would be dangerous.
No.
You can't give them like little candies to suck on because they'd, you know, they just suck them into their lungs and aspirate them. Then they have to go to the emergency room. So what you do is you can use a mom can take a little bit of liquid xylitol and paint the teeth with it, or use a small soft brush, or just put some drops of xylitol on the child's tongue, and you know, then the child just, you know, just kind of floats around in their mouth and treats their teeth and gums, and also their little tiny pastilles, which aren't so big, and less chance of the kid aspirating. Although I think you need an older kid before you give them a little pastille, because you don't want to give it to a baby. The baby will just, you know, suck it in. And these little pastilles, tiny pastilles, like they're sort of the size of, you know what Sen-Sen are? You know, that little tiny breath mints.
Yeah.
So they,
what
you,
was Sen-Sen for?
It was sort of soapy tasting. I remember it was interesting. It was like it was a breath mint. You know, I remember when I was growing up, Sen-Sen was popular. Anyway, I don't know if it's still around, but the xylitol will protect the kid's baby teeth. Now you say, well, baby teeth, it doesn't matter because they come out anyway. Well, actually, it's very important for the adult teeth that the baby teeth don't rot, because when the baby teeth are damaged or you have to pull them, it sets the stage for poor adult teeth and poor dental health.
So
the products are coming to the brand name Spry, S-P-R-Y, made by the Clear company, X-L-E-A-R. And it's called the Spry Dental Defense System, and it's like a lifetime thing, you know, all ages. And it's actually not a bad idea for mom to treat herself. I'll tell you why. It turns out that kissing can transmit mouth bacteria, and moms kiss their babies and transmit their mouth bacteria to the babies. So if a pregnant woman or a woman who's just given birth, not a bad idea for her to chew the xylitol. The xylitol won't, you know, go into the fetus through the placenta, but you will be able to retard the proliferation of the bad bacteria that are responsible for dental decay.
Terrific. Okay.
Good stuff,
Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah, we hope that answers your question, Harry. We have yet another question, Dr. Hoffman, about black cumin seed oil.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Joyce. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I've been hearing a lot about black cumin seed oil and its claims that it cures everything except death.
Right.
Is it true that it helps?
It's the new mangosteen, I think. You know, you know, it's one of those things like that. You know, or you know, I think that it's an oil from cumin, and just as oil from oregano and rosemary. These are all very plausible as antioxidants, and have antibacterial effects, anti-inflammatory effects. And I prescribed it for some patients of mine with asthma. I don't yet carry it in my dispensary, but I think it's got promise. I'd like to see some more research on it. We needed more quality research, such as on a supplement like pycnogenol. There's lots of research. And green tea, there's lots of research. And resveratrol. These are curcumin, fantastic research. But not enough research yet on black cumin seed oil, although I think it's one of those plausible things that could help.
There's been a small amount of animal research, like in colon cancer. They found that black seed oil has significant inhibitory effects against colon cancer in rats.
Okay.
How do you do
a colonoscopy on a rat?
It has lots of uses.
It's like, you know, the rat saying to himself, like, let's go back in the subway. Man, this job is rough.
Oh, no.
I'm going to go hang out in Grand Central again, because this science stuff, forget about it. You know, I'm not going to volunteer for an experiment ever again. You know.
The other name for it, it's actually black cumin seed oil is from the flowering plant Nigella sativa.
Mm-hmm.
It's another way to look it up, Joyce. And you're asking about dosages, but I would just follow the dosage on the brand that you're getting. We don't want to advise you on how much, because we don't know you.
I'm suggesting like one capsule twice daily. You know, we're probably safe. We don't know. More, you know, sometimes more is better, sometimes not.
Yeah. Among some of the other things that it's good for, asthma, as you mentioned, Dr. Hoffman, also high blood pressure, Helicobacter pylori infection, which can cause ulcer, type 2 diabetes, and a myriad of other things. So, thank you for your question, Joyce. Okay. Our next question is from Bo. I take about...
Bo's a gal or a guy?
Don't know.
Oh, okay.
Can't tell here.
It's B-O?
I think he's a guy. B-E-A-U.
Oh, well, that would be like Bo Bridges. That's a guy.
He says, no,
you know why? I'll tell you why I know that. Because in French, a man is attractive, you say, il est beau. And if a woman is attractive, you say, elle est belle.
Ah, yes.
Okay.
Bow and bell.
Right. The bows and the bells. Well, that's supposed to, you know, antebellum South, you know.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
Down in the plantation.
So, Bo takes about 12 supplements. He doesn't like to have to swallow them all. So, he has two questions. Could I just put all my vitamins in a Nutribullet and make a shake and take it that way?
Wow.
And are there any powdered vitamin mixes?
Yeah. Well, you know, if you do that and you put it in the Nutribullet, and you are going to have one sour tasting mash.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it, you
know.
Totally. Yeah. So, you know, I guess you could, but, you know, I'd also be concerned about the irritating effects of some of these things on your esophagus, because the esophagus is a little sensitive, and, you know, these are... Some of these supplements are caustic and irritating, and swallowing them down, I'm not so sure if that's going to be a great idea.
I have a suggestion for Bo. He's taking 12 supplements, and what he could do is break them up over 3 meals a day.
Yeah.
So he doesn't necessarily have to take 6 at a meal and then 6 again. He could break those up even further. And, you know, you and I know the best way to take supplements is while we're eating, just take them and continue eating. Chew, swallow, take another supplement, a little bit of water, you know, chew, swallow. What were we comparing notes on how many capsules we could swallow, Dr. Hoffman?
That's a machismo thing.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I can only do about 3 or 4 capsules.
Right.
But if there's a tablet there, the tablet has to go down on its own.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, so what do we do? We do have some patients occasionally who say that they absolutely cannot swallow pills. And, you know, some of them have esophageal problems, and some of them just have a very pronounced gag reflex. They can't swallow pills. So we sometimes suggest powdered vitamins, although I think that's inferior.
It is. The powdered vitamins also are, like, made of food, and there are some people with food sensitivities who don't tolerate that well.
Mm-hmm.
That's my only problem with, like, a whole foods powdered effervescent thing. So... Yeah,
right.
A little bit hit or miss there.
Right. And then there's some people say, look, I can't take anything orally. Just give it to me intravenously. and they want to get IV everything, you know, but we can't just shake a bunch of vitamins into an IV bag, add saline, you know, smush it up and give it to you by vein.
Why
because
not?
That sounds great. You know, it's like,
it does sound great. There could be IV lounges. Get your vitamin drip.
A lot of people would like to get their coffee that way in the morning. It's just like hold out their arm and, you know, stick in the needle. But the problem with that is that vitamins have to be sterile, number one. They have to be non-crystalline because you don't want to put little shards or fragments into your blood vessels. You might think, well, gee, Dr. Robin, you can get anything. You can get intravenous curcumin. You can get intravenous resveratrol. Can't you? And the answer is no. The answer is no. I mean, yes, under very rigorous laboratory circumstances, you might be able to get some of these pure materials at $2,500 an ounce or something like that, or a gram. You know, these would be prohibitively expensive to administer these types of things. And also, there's a lot of regulation increasingly, and it's even getting hard for us to get some of our traditional staples, you know, when we want to get something like selenium or manganese or molybdenum. These are getting harder to source because of regulation that's being imposed on compounding pharmacies. We're going to talk about that more and more this year because there's pending legislation that really threatens to put the throttle hold on our ability to give intravenous therapies to patients.
That's unfortunate. Yeah.
So we have time for another question.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you both for that question. We have a question from Karen. Love this podcast, listen often, have learned so much. Thank you, and keep it coming. We are listening.
Great.
Please discuss herbs and supplements which can help early COPD and hopefully stop it from progressing.
Okay. Well, there was a big article this week about fish consumption in COPD. Mm. And so, you know, clearly eating fish, but probably taking fish oil capsules is going to have an anti-inflammatory effect on this lung disorder.
Yeah.
So that could be important. What else can you think of?
I think NAC and acetylcysteine is very important.
Glutathione precursor, yep.
Yeah.
I would give a person intravenous glutathione if they could, or aerosolized glutathione. That really helps.
Good results with that.
Yeah, we put it into an atomizer that breaks the particles down, and you inhale it like a vapor, the way that sometimes medication is administered, and that coats the lungs. And it's been very helpful for some of our patients. They don't have to come every time to get the treatment at the Hopkins Center. We just can give them a nebulizer. Often they have nebulizers already for administration of medication, and then they just put a few drops of the glutathione solution in the nebulizer, inhale it, and it's really good for the lungs. It really has an antioxidant that acts directly on the interior surfaces of the bronchioles and alveoli in the lungs to protect them from inflammation.
Yeah. I imagine then everything else in our anti-inflammatory arsenal, curcumin, boswellia, possibly.
You know, curcumin has actually been written up for its ability to slow the progression of even cystic fibrosis. I saw a very serious article a few years back in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is very, very skeptical towards nutraceuticals, talking about the potential of curcumin to slow the progression of this very, very dread form of lung disease, cystic fibrosis.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Another thing I want to mention to Karen, because she has early COPD, it's very important to be on a COPD diet. We want to be able to lower the burden of exhalation on your lungs, meaning the carbon dioxide load in the body. And by eating a high-carb or even moderate carbohydrate diet can increase the amount of carbon dioxide made in the body, which then the lungs have to expel. So by implementing a very low-carb, high-fat diet, it helps decrease the burden on the lungs by decreasing carbon dioxide.
Right.
So that's helpful for COPD.
And do you know what? Yeah, this is interesting about lung physiology is, you know what gives you the feeling of breathlessness? It's not so much lack of oxygen, it's excess carbon dioxide And when that carbon dioxide builds up, it just makes you feel really awful. And so...
So then it's time to yawn.
Yes, yes, yeah. Very good. Yeah, it may be our body's way of discharging excess carbon dioxide. But, you know, clearly carbon dioxide is produced by burning carbohydrates to some extent. So you can reduce your what's called
carbon dioxide and water being the end product of...
Of burning glucose.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Glycolysis, yeah.
Right. So the science of it is that you change your respiratory quotient by, if you burn fat as your fuel as opposed to carbon dioxide, you will actually have less carbon dioxide residue. Now, this, I have to say, this, if you have very mild COPD, you won't notice a difference. But if you're a real huffing and puffing individual...
We're talking emphysema and stuff.
Yeah.
Bronchitis.
Right. Then you will notice a difference if you change your diet. Now, one disadvantage with this kind of diet is if you don't add a lot of fat, one thing that happens to these people with COPD is they become very sarcopenic. They lose body mass because it takes so much energy to breathe that they waste away. So you need to supply the calories in the form of healthy fats, you know, lots of omega-3 fish oil and olive oil and possibly coconut oil. These are some things that can help to... change the balance so that not as much carbon dioxide is produced, but also so that the patient isn't starving from caloric withdrawal. Possibly things like pycnogenol I might consider. There's plenty of studies show that vitamin D may be a mediator in this too, so you have to make sure there's adequate vitamin D. And
Make sure there's adequate vitamin D, no matter what your health condition.
Absolutely. Yeah. The new condition that was cited today was if you have a stroke, those who have a low vitamin D have a much greater likelihood of long-term disability with a stroke than those who have adequate vitamin D.
Wow.
So, you know, it's not like this is people already having a stroke, okay? It's not like you have plenty of vitamin D, you'll be bulletproof. You know, you won't get a stroke. I mean, stuff happens to people no matter what vitamins they're taking. But if you are to get a stroke, the stroke will be milder and you'll have a greater chance of recovery of function if your vitamin D is adequate. So that's important.
All right. Thank you, Karen, for your question.
I think that's all the time we have for questions today. But it's been a good session. We answered a lot of questions and we have more in the mailbag, and we encourage you to send your questions to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we will endeavor to answer as many of them as possible on future editions of Q&A with Layla. So thanks very much, Layla, for joining us.
Thank you. And
stay warm.
Yes, you too.
and fend off seasonal affective disorder.
Absolutely.
And maybe we'll talk a little bit about that next week.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.